5 nuclear loci. We find the Yupsudasoma group up here with some elements of the Halicidota group. Eucades comes out monophyletic, and the rest of the Halicidota group come out monophyletic. And I'll come back to the problem of the tanukines and euchromienes a little later. Okay, so what I'm going to do is focus in on each of those phygopterine clades. Milkweed tussocks, there is a core set of genera. Unfortunately, Ophrys procoroides is the type of Ophrys, but no other Ophrys goes in that genus that we know of. So that very large genus has got to be revised, and we also don't know what it feeds on. But as far as we know within the rest of the group, cardiac glycosides is widespread, the use, or at least the larval host, and it has consequences for the adult mating systems, which I won't go into now, but if you're interested, it's in the DaCosta paper. So here we see a switch from PA dependence, which is in the outgroups, to a CG dependence. Examples of the Yupsudasoma group, an amazing array of caterpillar types, and host plants, and because we have no phylogeny of the group, I can't begin to trace the evolution of the morphologies or the host use. That's a needs-to-be-done group. Similarly, the Halicidota group, which is characterized by wing venation, and the larvae tend to have these pencils in the tufting in the front and the back, and you can see those characteristic tufts here again. A very interesting host plants occur in this group. There are probably a lot of switches from PAs to CGs and other compounds, but again, the phylogeny is just a figment of my imagination, and I won't bore you with it right now. Some interesting life histories and morphologies that I want to focus on actually are in Malacea and Bertholdia, and Bertholdia is where we find a return to lichenivory. Now, Dan Jansen at this point is probably sitting up and going, what? You might recall that in the old literature, Bertholdia is said to feed on citrus leaves. Well, it turns out they don't feed on citrus leaves as first, second, or third instar larvae. They feed on the epiphytic growth on citrus leaves. And then, about third instar, they drop off, they stop feeding on epiphytic growth and become polyphagous. So if you look at the rearing records on the ACG website, you'll see that they're reared from a variety of host plants. And so what we see is a return to polyphagy and a return to epiphytic feeding. A very fascinating life history that's been documented by John Rollins and Nancy Jacobson and myself, and I don't know how widespread this behavior is when you get up here in the Halicidota group, but something to watch out for if you're trying to raise caterpillars in the field. Okay, so moving along, the evolution of life histories. We're just going to take a peek at what we know about tanukines and euchromienes. We have a preliminary phylogeny for the tanukines and euchromienes. Please visit Sarah Johnson's poster tomorrow to learn more about it. And I just want to show you that we have a lot of phylogenetic work to do. Here's Eucerion in a couple of places. These are larvae of Eucerion. These are larvae, the top one of Eucerion. Obviously a diversity of larval types, not related to each other. We've got a lot of work to do. Very cute euchromienes. Gosh, aren't they drop-dead gorgeous? Okay, so a summary of trends and directions. Based on what we know, which obviously we've got a lot of phylogenetic work left to do, we can definitely say there is a fungal lichen relationship in the syntomine lithosiine lineages, and that this reappears in Bertholdia and maybe other Arctiani in the broad sense. PA use evolves in the ancestor of Arctiani, and PA opportunism or self-medication appears to be the hallmark of Arctiani, with potentially reversal to that again in the higher phygopterines, whatever that group is. Host chemistry specialization evolves multiple times, and we will need better phylogenies to actually trace down how many times these specializations occur and in what directions. The other results you see up on the slide are fairly self-evident. If you'd like to learn more about tiger moths, and this will be my close, Bill Connor has an edited book that will be coming out next year. Dave Wagner has an excellent chapter on Arctia larvae in that. Ring Carday has a nice chapter on pheromones, and a whole bunch, anything you ever wanted to know about Arcteas will be in this book. Promise. With that, I thank my funding sources, Leptree.net, and all my collaborators. Thank you.
Thank you. One question, and then we're going to have a break, and we'll be back here at 10:05.
Yes, Mike? Yeah, so Mike's comment, in case you couldn't hear it in the back, is that the machinery, the neurophysiological and I forgot the other big word you just used, it's all there to both recognize PAs, eat them, sequester them, and pass them on to the adult stage, but that whole developmental program is not expressed, and it's later on in Arcteids that you see the canonization into a certain direction. It's a very striking fact. And you've got a chapter in Bill's book, right? Yeah. Sorry, I left out. another question, Dan?
How comfortable are you with this idea of subsuming our deity inside of Noctuity?
Oh, I thought someone might ask that. How comfortable am I with calling Arcteids Noctuids? In the phylogeny chapter in Bill's book, I point out that what we really have here are competing taxonomies and incomplete analyses. And so before I agree with major taxonomic changes, I would like to have the data analyzed. And right now we have the morphology trees that have been proposed by Fibinger and LaFontaine, and then the second paper by LaFontaine and Fibinger, they've not been subjected to a rigorous cladistic analysis. It's Hennigian argumentation, and actually the trees are different between the two papers if you look at the papers closely. And I'm not saying they're wrong, I'm just saying they're hypotheses that are evolving, and if I would be happy to call Arcteids Arebids, because they seem to go there with molecular data. But again, the sampling by Mitchell et al., which suggests that, that study was not designed to answer that question. And so I feel we really don't know. And I would prefer to leave Noctuity as Mitchell et al. Had circumscribed it. And we don't know where some of the former Noctuid subfamilies go. I'm okay with that. We have these enigmatic micro-Noctuids that just showed up on the radar screen. And so I'm still calling it Arcteity, even though Mike Fibinger says, you know, you're like a female Atlas holding Arcteity up on your back and just being stubborn. I'm like, okay, so I'm persistent. But no, I think it's as I concluded in that chapter, I think it's really an exciting time in Noctuid systematics. We're really not settled.
This is the best insect in our study. Papaya mealybug is a polyphagous mealybug, and it has more than 60 host plant species of tropical and subtropical fruits, vegetables, and ornamentals. This species is believed to be native to Mexico and Central America. Currently, this is established in the Caribbean, the US, and the Pacific. In the US, this was first found in Florida in 1998. This is the damage caused by papaya mealybug to the papaya plants, they colonize on the leaves, and you can see the veins and midribs getting yellowish and drying up. In the tender leaves and buds get deformed and distorted. They directly colonize on the fruits, secrete honeydew, and you can see the black sooty mold development. Classical biological control was identified as a suitable method to control papaya mealybug. Currently, there are three parasitoid species, mass-reared in Puerto Rico and released in mealybug-infested areas in the Caribbean, the U.S., and the Pacific. The three parasitoid species are Asteropagus papayae, Pseudoleptomastix mexicana, and Anagyrus locki. They all belong to family Encytidae. In South Florida, in Miami-Dade and Broward counties, these three parasitoids were released in July 2003 by USDA APHIS in 21 locations as a single release attempt. And out of these 21 locations, five locations are in Homestead where we conducted our field study. There's very little research done to find the effectiveness of these three parasitoid species. So our objective of this study is to determine the field effectiveness of Asteropagus papayae, Anagyrus locki, and P. mexicana. In order to achieve our objective, we did the cage studies using hibiscus plants in the landscape, and we checked the presence of natural enemies, level of parasitism, and identification of these parasitoids and other natural enemies. We had three locations in Homestead, and each location we had 10 hibiscus plants. Before and during our experiments, there has not been any insecticide used in all three locations. And we carried out this experiment in summer 2005 and 2006. We use sleeve cages to develop papaya mealybug populations, and we selected three branches from each hibiscus plant, cleaned them, and put these sleeve cages. For each cage, we add 5 gravid females of papaya mealybug. We allow these females to lay eggs, and eggs to hatch and develop into second and third instars. When the population was roughly approximately about 1-to-1 ratio of second and third instars, we started our treatment. We had three treatments. The first treatment we called closed sleeve cage, for which we kept the sleeves closed from both ends. Our second treatment, open sleeve cage, for which we opened the sleeves from both ends. And the third treatment, we removed the sleeve cage, so we called it no cage treatment. At 24, 48, and 72-hour intervals, we took counts of mealybug destroyer, adults and larvae, and spiders. After 72 hours, all these branches were covered with closed sleeve cages, and removed these from the plant and taken to the laboratory. In the lab, we check the number of mealybugs survived in each cage, and we check these mealybugs for percent parasitism. So these are the results we found for the mealybug survival. We have our three treatment axes: closed sleeve cage, open sleeve cage, and no cage treatment. We found the highest number of mealybugs in the closed sleeve cage treatment, for which the mealybugs were not exposed to environment or the natural enemies. And the lowest number we found in the no cage treatment, for which the mealybugs were totally exposed to environment and the natural enemies. And we found moderate number of mealybugs in the open sleeve cage. For that, mealybugs were partially exposed to environment and natural enemies. These are the number of individuals we found for the mealybug destroyer adults and larvae. We found both adults and larvae in our treatment. We have a treatment, this axis. We didn't find any in the closed sleeve cage treatment. We have an open sleeve cage and no cage treatment in this axis. Among the intervals, we didn't find any pattern in the number collected for both adults and larvae, but within an interval, we found higher number of mealybug destroyer adults and larvae in the no cage treatment than open cage treatment. Here, the mealybugs were exposed to environment and had easy access for the natural enemies. These are the number of individuals we collected for the ants and spiders. We have our treatment, this axis open sleeve cage and no cage treatment. Here also we didn't find any in the closed sleeve cage treatment. Among the intervals, we didn't find any pattern in the number collected, but we found within an interval higher number of ants in the no cage treatment than open cage treatment. We found three types of ants, and Tapinoma sessile was the predominant ant species found in this study. We found seven spider species. Again, among the intervals, we didn't find any pattern, but within an interval, we found higher number of spiders in no cage treatment than open cage treatment. Among these seven spider species, we didn't find any predominant spider species. So these are the results for percent parasitism. We have our treatment, this axis, open sleeve and no cage treatment. In the closed sleeve cage treatment, the mealybugs, we couldn't find any parasitism from the mealybugs we collected. We have our three parasitoids, this axis, Aceropegus papai, Anagyrus luki, and P. mexicana. We found higher number of Aceropegus papai in open sleeve cage than no cage treatment. Anagyrus luki, higher number in open sleeve cage than no cage treatment. But we didn't find any P. mexicana activity in either of the treatment. Within the treatment, we found a higher number of Aceropegus papai than Anagyrus luki for both open sleeve and no cage treatment. There's no information whether Aceropegus papai or Anagyrus luki, P. mexicana, having any other host other than papai mealybug. But literature says Anagyrus luki has two other hosts, Dismicoccus mealybug and Madeira mealybug. And Madeira mealybug is one of the common found mealybug species in South Florida. Overall, we found cumulative parasitism about 23% to 33%. And in Dominican Republic, they did some studies after releasing the parasitoids and found about 35% parasitism from the field collected mealybug. So our results support some of these studies conducted in other countries. Since we didn't find any information about P. mexicana activity, we did some laboratory study to find some more information about these three parasitoids. Here we checked the hostage preference, development time, and interspecific competition of these parasitoids. I'm not going to explain the methods we use. I'm directly going to the results of these studies. In the hostage combination, when we provided second and third insta papai mealybug, we found that Aceropegus papai and P. mexicana had similar preference for the hostage second insta, and Anagyrus luki has preference for third insta papai mealybug. In the development time of these three parasitoids, we found that Aceropegus papai and Anagyrus luki had similar development time, but P. mexicana had much longer development time for both males and females. When we consider the host development time, adult papai mealybug female can develop within 25.5 days, and is very closer to P. mexicana development time of about 23 days. And the interspecific competition study, we provided different mealybug combinations. We found that Aceropegus papai can compete well with Anagyrus luki or P. mexicana. Both Anagyrus luki or P. mexicana. In the third insta, we found that Anagyrus luki had higher percent parasitism when present with either Aceropegus papai or P. mexicana, or both. But we also found that Aceropegus papai had higher parasitism, reasonably higher parasitism when present with all three parasitoids in third insta. So our conclusions are: Aceropegus papai demonstrated superior characteristics in our field study, and they were supported by the results from our lab studies. We saw low parasitism from Anagyrus luki, and one reason can be due to their not being host specific. And we didn't see any, we didn't recover any P. mexicana activity, so we need some more field studies whether it has the ability to establish in the field. And presence of mealybug destroyer, spiders, and ants may have influenced the present parasitism. We like to thank all these people who helped us to conduct this experiment. Thank you very much. And if you have any questions, I'd like to ask them. Thank you.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what I've been doing with crepe myrtle aphid and some of its predators. And some of you might know the crepe myrtle aphid as Tinacalus kahalalokalani. However, its name is being changed back to Sauricalus based on some of its host plant records. Crepe myrtle aphids are relatively host-specific, feeding largely within the genus Logistrurhemia. Their damage is really cosmetic, in which black sooty mold grows on their honeydew. However, as far as we can observe, this isn't a long-term cost to the plant. Plants will completely defoliate, and the next year they will refoliate and bloom just as beautifully as in years before. You can see that their infestations get quite large, and this plant is completely black, and this is what a normal Appalachia looks like in the panhandle of Florida sometime in late July. It's attacked by a number of insect predators, including most of the aphid specialists, like the coccinellids and the chrysopids, and we see syrphids when they get into large populations. However, it's been explored throughout regions of Asia, and there are no parasitoids reported from this particular aphid species. This aphid species is also interesting in that all of the adults except for the ovipari are winged. The major types of Logistrurhemia that you'll see out there is you'll see Logistrurhemia indica, Logistrurhemia farii, and some hybrids. Now, Logistrurhemia indica is the original cultivars brought to the United States for ornamental purposes. The problem with it is it gets this powdery mildew on it. And Logistrurhemia farii does not get the powdery mildew, but it doesn't have all of the horticultural properties of Logistrurhemia indica. So they hybridized them at the National Museum in Washington, D.C., and they came up with cultivars that were resistant to powdery mildew that still retain those horticultural properties. Some of the previous research done with this system was by Mizell and Knox, and they showed that aphid susceptibility was related to this parentage of hybridization, and they showed that the hybrids were more susceptible to aphid attack than the pure Logistrurhemia indica cultivars. Pettis did some work with this also and showed that this was reversed in Coleoptera with Japanese beetle and the little blue beetle, Ulcica, and that the hybrids were more resistant to the beetles. I did some work with this with leaf disc experiments to look at no-choice tests, and my results from that look something like this. I want to explain this graph because it goes to a lot of my data slides. These are orthogonal contrasts that I set up based on the literature that parentage, pedigree, and mature plant height are influencing susceptibility to aphid and beetle attack. And so here I have the major parentages, the pure Logistrurhemia indica with medium and tall cultivars within there. I also have the hybrids. And if you notice in here, the hybrids actually have 1, 2, 3, this is a separate lineage of germplasm in which they were derived from. These cuttings came from cuttings along a river in Japan, and the seedlings were part of the